Well, here we are, Friday. You know what that means, right? Yeah, it means it's Friday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 11th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Lots and lots and lots to talk about as we look back on the past 5 days in this economy and ahead to next week as well, because the economic news never stops. Heather Long is at the Washington Post. Jordan Holman is at Bloomberg. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, so Heather, let me start with you, and I want to start with inflation. We got the CPI this week. Year over year, consumer price index is running at 5%, which is a lot by historical standards. Maybe not so much when you think about base effects, but let me ask you this. That is to say, base effects last year over this year. Here's the deal, though. We're talking about inflation all the time, transitory, this and that. The deal is, though, that consumers are feeling it. It's real, right? Gas is up, food is up. It's tangible.
It definitely is, especially for low-income consumers. We saw in that University of Michigan survey out today that the bottom third of earners are really pretty terrified about these rising prices. They obviously don't have a lot of extra money to adjust, and particularly what really worries me going forward, a lot of this stuff you can wave off, the base effects you were talking about, or things like airfares going up. It's, you know, they haven't added back enough flights yet. But when you start to really drill down on things like rent prices, you know, that is something that you usually lock in for a year or more. So that's not something that's just going to go away after the summer. And we're starting to see some pickup in things like rent prices. And so I think going forward, that's really what I'm focused on, how much of that sticks around.
Jordan, can you talk for a second about what you're hearing from the world of retail, right? I mean, CEOs must see this. Purchasing managers must see this. They know prices are going up. And we're going to talk, you know, consumer reaction to those prices in the next segment. But it's real for them as well.
Yes. And not only is it real and do CEOs see that, but they're making the decisions on raised prices. And they are really reticent right now to come out and really say that to consumers, that they're raising prices on them. With the exception of Chipotle, it was a big example that said it's happening. But what we're going to see from the consumer side is a lot of euphemism. So, you know, taking prices and we're being active with pricing. But, you know, consumers will automatically see price changes. It is interesting, though, that for some items that have been dormant during the pandemic, things that people weren't buying, like apparel and whatnot, it might not be so clear that, you know, your jeans are a little bit more expensive. So that it will be really interesting how consumers respond.
Heather, as we look toward next week and the Fed meeting and, you know, the zillion times that Chair Powell will be asked in his press conference on Wednesday about inflation and the equally zillion number of times that he will say, we believe it's transitory. I wonder if you agree with Mohamed El-Erian, who we had on the program on Monday. He said, in essence, he thinks the Fed has painted itself into a corner and that Powell has gone so hard on this. It's transitory. Everything's going to calm down inside a year. Don't worry about it. We got it. And I wonder what you think of that, whether he's just kind of jammed himself up.
He certainly made his life harder. I never quite say that they're painted into a corner because it is the Federal Reserve. And at the end of the day, they have a ton of power and a lot of options. And they can change their minds and go in a different direction. And basically, the whole world has to respond to that, kind of like a parent telling a toddler, you have to do something because I told you so. But I think what's really, really hard is they did a great job last year putting all of this, giving the world this gift of these low rates and lots of stimulus for the economy and the markets. And it's a lot harder to pull that stimulus back. And unfortunately, the Federal Reserve has a history of messing that up and messing it up really badly when they try to pull back their accommodation and their, you know, their gifts to the country and the world. And that's where, you know, Powell really hasn't been tested much on this. And there's not a great roadmap for it. And he, I think it's going to be probably the hardest meeting and press conference of his career so far on Wednesday, when he has to answer these questions in a way that's saying, we're watching it, we're on top of it, we won't let it get out of control, but we're not ready yet.
Yeah, but Heather, look, sorry not to keep beating up on Jay Powell, but you say he's got a lot of power, but I wonder how much of that power comes from the inferences and the nudge nudge wink winks that he does, as opposed to actually moving interest rates around. And he doesn't have, it seems to me, a lot of options.
Well, the best thing that happened to Jay Powell this week is after those inflation numbers came out that we've just been railing on, we did not see a big reaction from Wall Street. We did not see the bond market signaling terror about inflation. So right now, the market is sort of agreeing with Jay Powell. I think the harder time for him is really going to come maybe a bit later this summer, if we see more people sliding into the Mohammed El-Arian and the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who's been railing on inflation. It's sort of like a tug of war. And if those people start to win the messaging battle, then Jay Powell has a real problem.
So, Jordan, let me, talking about the power that exists in this economy, let me ask you about workers and the number that came out this week about job openings and employees quitting. More job openings in this economy than ever before. People are quitting their jobs at extraordinary rates because they believe they have the power to either get a better job, a higher paying job, or maybe one that doesn't make them face virus challenges. Workers have a lot of power right now, and it's a huge shift.
They do. And it is really interesting what's happening with the labor market. And you're seeing companies respond to this power that workers have. You're seeing companies boost wages, like the $15 an hour is really a conversation. It's becoming standard that CEOs have to grapple with this. And so, but that's just one side of the story. Another reason that we might be seeing workers quit is just that companies haven't actually responded enough to the work from home life, or are like forcing workers back into the office when some of the guardrails of schooling and other things that were really helpful for some workers during the pandemic are going to go away. So it's a very confusing market right now, but what remains to be seen is some of these incentives that companies are giving out to even get people to apply. Like, will that just be temporary as well? Or is that actually a shift that workers are giving more power in the long run?
Right. Heather, you spent a lot of time on the phone with workers in this economy. What's your sense of how they're feeling?
Definitely a lot more optimism. The best term I've heard lately is rage quitting. And so what you're seeing is a lot of workers who, kind of like what Jordan was saying, who aren't going to put up with the same stuff they used to put up with. So not only do they want higher pay, but they also want better working conditions. And right now, with over 9 million job openings in April and probably 10 million now, they have a lot of options. And it was amazing to me. We ran a story this week and from the employer side, and even a lot of restaurants in Charlotte and Charleston that had just raised their pay from 12 to 15 were suddenly getting flooded with applications. So it only takes a few, a little bit of an increase to totally change the game.
Yeah. All right. Super quick. We're going back to my favorite game show game. Heather, we're going to start with you because you've been down this road before. Fed meets next week. I want to know in 5 words or less, what is Jay Powell thinking? That's fair. That's fair.
Life.
That's fair too, because maybe he just doesn't want to say anything. I'd go with "Leave me alone, please." Now, how about that? How about that?
That sounds good to me. You're better at headline writer than I am.
All right, we're gonna bail on that note, Jordan. You're off the hook because who knows what Jay Powell is thinking right now? Jordan Holman of Bloomberg, Heather Long at the Washington Post. Thanks, you two. I appreciate it.
Thanks, guy.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, I don't know if they know what Jay Powell's thinking. Nobody seems very excited about anything right now. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. to do a little behavioral economics in this next block, specifically how and why we spend our money the way we spend our money, like Jordan was talking about. The University of Michigan's preliminary consumer sentiment numbers for June came out today. We're a little more confident in the economy than we were in May. Seems we're worried about inflation and the rising prices of things like cars and homes. So could that, and here's the thesis, could inflation and worries about it affect how consumers are consuming? We asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to find out.
Chuck Howard grew up in Canada and says last year he found himself confronted with one of those things that he's often studying. Oh, right. Now is where I tell you that Howard is a behavioral scientist. He teaches marketing at Texas A&M University. He's also a consumer, and he had to ask himself whether it made sense to take this job and move his family from Vancouver to a small town in Texas.
A big part of why we moved here was the simple quality of life. A dollar goes much further here than it does in a lot of other places.
What you'll pay for a house in Bryan, Texas is way less than in Vancouver. So more house for less money means more to spend elsewhere, right? But Jeremy Burke at the University of Southern California says we put things in what behavioral economists call mental accounts. And we also don't transfer savings from one to another.
No one thinks about how much I should spend on cereal in response to changes in gas prices, even though changes in gas prices affect our overall budget. We don't think about it in that way. We think about things very narrowly.
We also notice more when prices go up than when they go down. And Suzanne Hsu at Cornell says we also care about why they're going up.
As humans, we are very interested in all of the inputs. And if we know that the inputs have increased in price as well, or there's inventory or logistics problems, then we're much more accepting of the fact that the price of the item we're looking to buy is increasing.
She says it's when we can't pin down a reason that people start getting frustrated, and they may decide just not to buy something from a business they think is jacking up prices just because it can. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Speaking of jacking up prices, or more temperately, raising prices because of higher input costs, one reason prices are going up, is because there's not enough of whatever it is that people want to buy. Electronics and appliances, furniture, bicycles, you name it, we've talked about it. So what happens to consumer spending when those consumers can't find what they want? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is on that one.
Last year, Kristen Nelson's gas stove broke, so she ordered a new one, this time with an induction cooktop.
It's the one that uses magnets.
She was trying to be environmentally conscious. She bought it in September.
And, you know, I was told it would come in November, and I was like, I guess I can do 2 months. It'll be okay. And every month I got a message that said it was coming later and later.
She ate a lot of salad and microwaved eggs. The stove arrived in March. If she'd known it was going to take that long, she would have looked at other options. When retailers don't have the product you want, you have a choice to make. Wait, change your plans, or buy something else. Mark Iampieri at the consulting firm Alex Partners says retailers are thinking about that buy something else part as they buy inventory because they want to be able to say, okay, we don't have the bike your kid wants, but how about a scooter or a hoverboard?
You can, you know, supplement your assortment with products like that that maybe aren't the first choice.
He says customers are often willing to consider different brands and styles if it's a time-sensitive purchase. Like the fridge breaks, or even they want patio furniture. And I mean, it's June, you know, clock's ticking.
And in some cases, they have to be willing to switch between style or they're going to miss the season.
The other element here is price. Even if people find what they want, the fact that there's a shortage will likely make it more expensive. And that can push them to buy something cheaper or not buy at all. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
I know our podcasts have been a little slow to download lately. Don't blame us. Blame Apple. But if you miss us on the air, you can get us on demand. Coming up.
We got delicious food from restaurants cooked by other people.
One of the benefits of getting away. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, basically flat, 34,479, up just a touch, the blue chips. NASDAQ picked up 49 points, about 0.3%. 14,069. The S&P 500 up 8 points, about 0.2%, 42.47. For the week, the Dow down 0.8%. The NASDAQ went the other way, up 1.8%. The S&P 500 picked up about 0.4%. Sweeping new bipartisan legislation in Washington is taking aim at the raw economic power of big tech. We use that phrase on purpose because it's true, raw economic power. A package of five bills could force big companies to overhaul their business practices or even split apart. Long way to go, of course. But those companies in question, Amazon, down less than 0.1% today. Google parent Alphabet, down 0.2%. Facebook, off 0.3%. Apple, of course, because it's Apple, up 0.9%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is that quote about integrity, or maybe it's ethical behavior, that the marker of it is that that's what you do when nobody's looking. With apologies to whoever it was who said that, a corporate twist might be ethical behavior is what you do when they pay you for it. There was a report out not too long ago from the London Business School that says almost half of the UK's top 100 companies are paying their CEOs a special bonus for running the business ethically. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
A wide range of companies now pay their CEOs an ethical bonus, from a Swiss pharmaceutical giant in the business of developing life-saving drugs,
Novartis was created to innovate,
to the British online retailer Boohoo, operating in the very different field of fast fashion.
Hey guys! I'm Amy.
I'm Star.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Tammy.
And we're on set with Boohoo!
45 of the UK's top 100 corporations now pay their chief executives a bonus for meeting environmental, social and corporate governance standards. Or in other words, says Martin White of the campaign group UK Shareholders Association, for running the business in a responsible manner.
I think that if you're paying somebody to run a company, you shouldn't give them a bonus for doing their job properly.
Protecting the environment, combating climate change, looking after your workforce, promoting diversity and not ripping off your customers are surely just part of the modern CEO's job, he says.
If you've got an executive who won't behave well unless you give them a bonus, should you really have them managing our companies?
Annabelle Denham of the Free Market Institute of Economic Affairs also has doubts about the ethical bonus. She thinks it looks suspiciously like a ruse.
I do think that this is just an opportunity for companies to pay their CEOs more without being lambasted by social media and the public.
Executive pay hikes are much easier to defend when they're tied to a worthy cause.
But I do think that this ethical bonus is quite a neat way for businesses to deflect criticism.
Criticism of executive pay that's ebbed and flowed in Britain over the past 30 years. At this pivotal meeting of British Gas shareholders in the 1990s, irate investors protested at the 75% pay raise awarded to Cedric Brown, the boss of the privatised utility. One of the shareholders expressed his opposition to the hike by turning up at the meeting with a pig named Cedric.
Come on, Cedric.
How are they, boys?
A little bit more, Cedric, yeah. Every one of the bosses has had their nose in this drop.
30 years on, Cedric Brown's salary of $750,000 seems rather modest. Today, the UK average for a top 100 company CEO is more than $5 million, vastly outstripping workers' pay. Simon Rawson of Share Action, which campaigns to make investment a force for good.
CEO to worker pay ratios have been increasing year on year. They now average about 200 to 1, so the CEO earns 200 times the median worker's salary.
The equivalent figure in the US is more than 260. But while Rawson thinks executive pay is too high, he doesn't object in principle to the ethical bonus.
I think that targets which incentivise sustainable behaviours by companies is not a bad thing.
Provided, he says, the targets are both challenging and clearly defined. But that, say the critics, is the problem. The board gets to massage the targets, make them easier to achieve, and ensure the bonus is always paid. The critics say if executives want to show how ethical they really are, they should scrap the company's ethical bonus. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I say this having just asked to extend my August time off for an extra 2 days and feeling, honestly, a little bit guilty about it. But we Americans, we do vacation really, really badly. As in, we just don't take it like we should. But after more than a year of being cooped up and burned out in this pandemic, the prospect of getting out of and away from the house, slash office, slash school, slash daycare, is especially appealing this summer. So might we finally be changing our minds about the value of taking time off? Maybe, but as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, the forces that have made us a no-vacation nation, they run deep.
Nicole Wong really tried to unplug last summer. Because her family couldn't travel, she created a vacation for her husband and four-year-old son at home in San Jose, California.
We planned a Hawaiian-themed staycation in our backyard and ate Hawaiian food and did Hawaiian-themed activities, including snorkeling.
In the hot tub, that is, where they definitely can't do the breaststroke. So it was a big deal when last week they finally went on an actual trip to Monterey Bay.
We stayed in a hotel and we got delicious food from restaurants cooked by other people and explored new areas, relaxed in a large swimming pool.
You know, big enough to actually swim in.
Oh my goodness, it was a lot more rejuvenating than I thought it would be.
Wong was pretty ready to hit the pool after the last year, but her employer sweetened the deal. She's a training director for business service firm PwC, which, get this, is offering employees a $250 cash incentive for every week of vacation they take off. Workers banked so much extra vacation time during the pandemic, the company is literally paying them to use it. That's how hard it can be to get Americans to take a break.
For the last 35 or 40 years, we've developed a kind of cultural ethos that devotion to work is also a devotion to the self.
Jamie McCallum is a sociologist at Middlebury College and the author of Worked Over, How Round-the-Clock Work is Killing the American Dream. He says before the pandemic, more than half of workers in the U.S. didn't use all their paid vacation, wasting more than 700 million days a year.
Long hours and overcommitment and loyalty sort of trump everything else. And therefore, asking for time off is seen as like a cultural no-no.
Not to mention, almost a quarter of workers in the U.S. don't get paid vacation, says Eileen Applebaum, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
It's very different when this is just part of normal work life. People get paid time off.
The European Union, for example, mandates at least 4 weeks of vacation, and many member countries go beyond that. The U.S. is the only wealthy country that doesn't guarantee some paid time off. So even when workers get it,
people feel that it's a gift from their employer to let them have the benefit of paid time off, and you don't want to overuse it.
American workers also have economic incentives to value work over play, says Dora Gacheva, an economist at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Because salaries vary so widely in the U.S., there's a bigger perceived payoff for working hard to climb the career ladder.
So it's this rat race type of story where everybody else around you is not taking vacation and working long hours. And so you're going to do it too because the promotion comes with a big pay raise.
The pandemic has widened economic inequality and left some workers feeling more precarious than ever. But it's also built support for worker benefits like paid sick time and family leave. And sociologist McCallum says it's profoundly changed how we think of work and life.
The ability to experience a different kind of work-life balance or a different kind of role for the home and family and even maybe a close circle of friends might displace some of that love for job.
They might even take a vacation without getting paid to do it. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. If you are not doing anything tomorrow, might I recommend tuning into the live stream of the auction for a seat on Jeff Bezos's suborbital space rocket. Sadly, registration for the live auction is closed, but I will just posit here that as much as we love our listeners, and we do, it's probably a safe bet not too many of you have got the spare $5 million-ish dollars it will take to win. If I'm wrong, please email me. Let's talk. Current high bid is $4.8 million. You will be sharing, you should know, the capsule with Bezos and his brother Mark. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context, just because it's Friday and we could all use a good eye roll. In an interview with Bloomberg today, the CEO of Lamborghini said he's almost sold out for the whole year. I guess rich people got some pent-up demand too, huh? Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.